Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode of Developer Tea. My name is Jonathan Cottrell. In today's episode, we have a discussion with a founder and CEO, Dan Pupias, created Range to help teams work better together. Now, before I lose you on that, it really is what Dan cares about. He wants teams to work better together, and he wants to create psychologically safe environments, and he has been hands-on designing this product to help teams do just that. And Range is a very simple application at the time of the recording of this episode, but as we discuss in the episode, Range is driven more by purpose than it is by specific features. I'm excited to talk with Dan, so let's get straight into the interview with Dan Pupias. Dan, welcome to Developer Tea.
Hi.
I'm excited to have you on the show, and I want to kind of kick off this episode with a question that sometimes I leave until the end. It's one of the kind of the two main questions that I like to ask at the end, but I think you might have some really interesting answers to these questions. So the first question I want to ask you is, what do you wish more people would ask you about?
Yeah, when you told me you were going to ask this, I actually kind of struggled because I'm often just curious to talk about whatever people are interested in. I think the answer would be is like the human side of engineering and thinking about the human systems and the like organization design. I think that's super fascinating and is often more challenging than the technical aspects of the work.
I'm going to dig in on this because I agree with you. And I think the specifics of how this plays out is really interesting. We're going to dig into it in just a second. But first, I want to take a minute and let you introduce yourself. Mm-hmm. I guess we jumped right over that. Can you tell listeners, you know, who you are and a little bit about Range?
Yeah, so my name's Dan Pupias, co-founder and CEO of Range. And we started Range a few years ago with the goal of helping teams work better together. We believe that there needs to be a balance between well-being and productivity. And we want organizations to aspire to create these environments where people, where everyone feels empowered and engaged. And we do actually feel that software has a role to play in that since software facilitates so many of the work processes. So we started with asynchronous communication as a way of providing, foundation for teamwork. And today Range at its core is a check-in tool. So it's a simple status update that people do usually daily. They share their plan for the day and what they've got done, but also how they're feeling. So it's a little bit like a stand-up, but we integrate with all the tools that you use. So it's really easy. It integrates with your workflow and then also creates a lot more transparency into the work stream. So that's it today. And people use it to, teams like Twitter and Airbnb, and they use it to stay connected and, know what's happening across their team.
I love the way you describe your product as what it is today, because it does two things. One, it lets people know that, hey, you know what, we didn't set out with this grand vision to create a stand-up thing. That's right. What you've discovered over time is an effective tool. And then also you leave space to change it in the future. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
Yeah, totally. You can't boil the ocean, and it's a big mission. And we want to help facilitate all work processes in a way that actually makes work more engaging and pushes authority and decision-making out to the edges of the organization. But we needed to start somewhere. So we started with this check-in, a bit like a virtual stand-up. And the reason we liked that was it was a regular habit. It was a behavior that people were already doing that we could piggyback on. And then it is actually at the intersection of work. It's about what you've done and what you're working on, but then also the relationships between the team. So it was an opportunity to bridge that gap between the productivity and the team effectiveness.
Yeah, I love the idea that, our tools that we use every day, which developers we're very well known for loving our tooling, mm-hmm. And for also hating our tooling, but that's a different story, right? I'm curious, what do you see as, I'm just very interested in this idea of making our tooling one step more human. Mm-hmm. And so what do you see as some of the major downfalls of developer tooling, or maybe not just limited to developers necessarily, but product engineering teams, the tooling that we use? What are the kind of the major themes of problems that you see in that industry right now?
Oh, I mean, that's a big question. I'd rather talk about the opportunity versus the problems, but I guess some of the problems are not thinking around how the software gets used or the implications. So you can imagine some like a productivity tool that tracks what people are working on. And it sounds good in theory, but then it ends up being a surveillance tool, which mm-hmm. actually creates an environment that's not psychologically safe. So you can think about these unintended consequences. So I think the positive spin, I would say, is that, you know, Churchill said that we build the buildings, thereafter they build us. And I think it's the same for software. We build the software, but then the software changes how we behave and how we interact with people. So we have to think about software development intentionally about how people are going to use it and how people are going to relate to each other. And there's an anecdote from my time at Google that I've mentioned a few times around code review. So I worked on this library, JavaScript library, that was used across the company. And to start with, the internal code review tool just had your LDAP name. So it didn't even show your full name. It was just some like arbitrary string. And I'd get a code review and I'd often have this like visceral like hit of anger and frustration as soon as the code review dropped. And then if I did the code review, I'd end up being pretty harsh and aggressive. And I got some feedback that I was like scary to send code reviews to. So I realized that if I went to the team directory and looked at people's profile photo and you know, what team they worked on and what their name, then I would empathize more with them as a human. And then I'd come back to the code review and be much more reasonable in my relation with, and, you know, in my review feedback. So I think that's the role software has to play, is that it can humanize the recipient and it can help you give empathy into the people you're communicating with and the others in the system. And if you don't have that mentality at the outset, you can end up creating systems that can, you know, create anxiety and create tension between people where they doesn't really need to exist.
This is such an interesting concept to me because I think I've encountered so many software engineers who, when they think about tooling, they think about it purely as a means to an end. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just engineers, by the way. But engineers seem to have a particular lean in this direction because so much of what we deal with as engineers is trying to get behind the pretty layers and into mm-hmm. more the core. And so I think we often think about it as a means to an end, but actually, when you look at the behaviors, it's much more like a framing device. We have some bit of information that needs to be framed, and how it gets framed, the context that it's in, you know, what kind of meta information is mm-hmm. included, can totally change what you perceive. And I think that anecdote you just gave is a perfect example of this. It's the same information at the core, right? The code didn't change when you went and looked at the picture, mm-hmm. the directory. But your perception of the code was now contextualized a little bit differently. And so I wonder, you know, what do you think of this concept of technology or tooling as a frame rather than purely as a tool?
Yeah, I totally agree. So I kind of see software as architecture, and architecture shapes our behavior. And if you think about driving as an analogy, your goal is to get from A to B. And the end is being at B, but how you get there is very critical, and the architecture shapes your driving behavior. So if there's speed bumps or road signs, that will change how you drive. And if you actually remove line markings, it's been shown that people will slow down. Or if you make the street cobbled, that will change driving behavior. So the means are as important as the ends, because it actually shapes how the journey occurs. And then that can actually change where you end off as well. So I think the software is very similar, and you have to think about the process as well as the outcome.
Yeah, this is such an interesting point you make, because I actually just read a book called Chatter. Yeah, it just came out not too long ago. And in the book, one of the things they discuss is the effect of our environment on our well-being. Mm-hmm. In ways that we wouldn't necessarily intuitively expect. So, of course, you know, for example, being around green spaces. Yep. This is a very well-studied effect and unfortunately not very well known in kind of common culture. But green spaces can have a pretty dramatic effect on your well-being and on your cognition and a whole host of other things, biomarkers, et cetera. And so what you're saying to me, and I was just thinking as you're saying it, the A to B, you know, the journey or the destination didn't necessarily change, but you did. Mm-hmm. The person on the journey changed, and perhaps the people that are on the other end of that will change as well. And so it seems like a lot of our jobs as software engineering managers is to build environments rather than software, to build an environment where good software can be grown, very similar to kind of cultivating a garden. Do you see the role of the manager to be similar to that?
Yeah, totally. And I've used the gardener analogy before, and I think to tie this back to like one of your previous comments is that there really aren't ends, there are only means, and often we don't really know where exactly we want to end up. If we're a gardener, we don't know exactly what the tree is going to look like, and we just know that we want, you know, a Japanese maple that looks pretty and has like blooms in the summer. And we cultivate it and set the environment for it to grow and for it to be successful. And I think that's the same with teams. We have a vision or an idea about the destination, but we don't really exactly know where it is. And then it's very much about the journey, and the journey becomes exploratory. And then, I mean, this stretching the analogy a little bit, but you know, making sure that everyone who is on the team and who is working towards that destination, you know, that you get their perspectives and that they're able to contribute as much as they can. I think that was one of the realizations I had working with Ev at Medium, was that you know, he's a big product visionary, but he didn't have like an exact picture of what he wanted to be built. He had like a feeling of what it would be like if we succeeded. And then we had to build an organization which helped him explore the path to that vision and to realize what the destination really was versus setting a line in the sand that we have to like walk towards.
Yeah. When you said that you wanted a Japanese maple, in my head, I immediately translated that to, well, actually what you want is the feeling of looking at a Japanese maple, right? It's there could be many things that could get you there. And I think often the biggest mistake that I see both in individual contributors, but also in other managers, is that they'll look at, they'll look at a request for a Japanese maple, and instead of abstracting upward to, well, what you want is the feeling of looking at the Japanese maple, they'll go down even further, and they'll say, well, okay, so we want this specific type of Japanese maple, and we need this specific kind of soil, and we need these specific lighting conditions, and it continues to add more and more kind of imposition to the work. And that creates this kind of system of inflexibility, whereas if you were to abstract upward as a manager, you're kind of building in flexibility to the process because there's many pathways rather than kind of, you know, honing in on only a singular pathway.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that, especially when you're talking about customers and product, is that they ask for something that they think solves their needs. But then, so you have to dig a layer underneath, and like, what is the need that they actually have? And then how might you solve that? And often they don't have the best idea of what would actually serve them. And I think it was Henry Ford, which was, people would ask for a faster horse. They didn't ask for a car. So you have to get underneath the request and really empathize with their needs.
I want to ask you a question on this, because I've been thinking a lot about it lately. And, you know, I talk to my colleagues, I talk to my family even. My wife is a product owner herself. And I continue to kind of push this same point, which is, you ask about the underlying need, right? Mm-hmm. You say, okay, you're saying you want this thing, but what is it that you want to do with this thing? Or what is it that you need out of it? And you can continue up that chain of, okay, but why do you want that, right? Mm-hmm. You want this sales tool so that you can increase your throughput, and you want to increase your throughput because you believe it's going to increase your revenue. There is a point where you can ask questions that will get back to kind of fundamental human needs. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about, in your experience, where do you stop on that chain? Do you go all the way to that human need, or do you say, okay, we're going to kind of draw the line here because we can't really meet everything. We have to kind of choose our layer of abstraction.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a great, like, perfect answer. I think it's a judgment call. But if you think about Maslow's work, and like, everyone knows about the hierarchy of needs, though in his actual books, he doesn't talk about them as being a strict hierarchy. But if needs aren't satisfied, if lower level needs aren't satisfied, then you can't hope to achieve the high level needs. So in an organizational context, if people don't feel psychologically safe, or don't have some of their basic emotional and psychological needs taken care of, then they're never going to be able to take risks or perform to their full capabilities. It's definitely tricky, and it is a judgment call. And then you have to also look at, is this like system wide, or is this individual? But I think you start just answering the question, or asking the question of what do these people need, and then and digging as deep as you can. In the context of range, like, we think about that a lot, which is that we're building what, like, you described it as a stand-up tool, and people but I think when we look at the stand-up tool, we look at what people need to be effective. And we've really drilled it down to three fundamental pillars, which is transparency, purpose, and belonging. So knowledge is power. And in regressive organizations, information is hidden in order to consolidate power. But often it's not explicitly hidden, it's just not publicly available, or it's not in a format that you can easily access. So if we can create more transparency around what's happening in the organization, and artifacts that are being produced, like documents and designs and decks, then people have more knowledge, and then they have more context, and then they're able to better make decisions themselves. And then if you make decisions yourself, you're empowered. Whereas if you don't have that information, then you have to rely on other people. So transparency is one of the things we think about in the context of range. And then purpose is, burnout is a big topic at the moment. But one of the biggest causes of burnout is not really understanding how your work fits into the bigger picture. So if you can help, if someone can understand on a day-to-day basis that this work is important, even if it feels rote and repetitive, then that can really help them feel more engaged in their work. And then the final piece is belonging, and that's the precursor to psychological safety. So micro moments of vulnerability help you trust the people around you. Once you trust people, you feel a sense of belonging, and then that belonging is what creates the environment of psychological safety, and then you can take risks and push yourself and challenge yourself in ways that wouldn't be possible if you were if you didn't have that sense of safety.
Yeah, you mentioned something so interesting a moment ago about how it's not necessarily hidden, but it's not visible either. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that it's almost accidentally obscured.
Yeah, and I think, totally. Yeah. And it's often, it's not intentional, but then say that you started hearing about a project that was going on and you didn't know about it. And if you were not safe, like if you were in a psychologically safe environment, you would just say, hey, what's going on with this project? But if you weren't psychologically safe, you'd be like, oh, is there a reason that I'm not being told about this project? And maybe they don't trust me, or maybe I'm not seen as important. And you start writing these stories, and then that compounds. And that makes you feel less safe, and then you show up in meetings differently. So if you can work in the open and provide a lot of transparency in all the work that's happening in the organization, then people can, a lot of these anxieties can be calmed.
We'll get right back to my interview with Dan Pipias right after we talk about today's sponsor, Square. Unless you've been living under a rock or you don't take payments online, then you've probably heard about Square. In fact, you've probably used Square, even if you didn't know it. Square builds the Square Terminal. It's an all-in-one credit card device that has a 5.5-inch corner-to-corner touchscreen that's super easy to disinfect, which, as it turns out, is pretty important right now. It operates wirelessly with a long battery life and a built-in thermal printer for safe distanced payments. And most importantly to you, probably, it syncs seamlessly with your app via the Terminal API to accept Apple Pay, Google Pay, and other NFC payment methods, plus Magstripe and chip cards for a smooth checkout experience. Terminal API is also compatible with pretty much anything you are probably working on right now. For example, it's very easy to integrate with basically every mobile platform, like iOS, Android, Flutter, React Native, or Windows applications. And Square has your back. With Square, if you build with the Terminal API, you can take advantage of Square's end-to-end encryption, dispute management, and fraud detection. Connect your app to the all-in-one payments device that merchants love with a simple REST API. Head over to developertea.com/square. That's developertea.com/square. Thanks again to Square for sponsoring today's episode of Developer Tea. Yes, yes, yes. I want to talk a little bit more. I want to dig in on this subject because I think the idea of having this, and you're framing it as psychologically safe or psychologically unsafe environments, I think there's also some human bias that we bring to the table, the negativity bias, where if there is a void, we're going to tend to fill it with something, with the worst possible thing, right? Or at least a suboptimal thing. In this case, you didn't know about the project, and so the natural belief may not be extreme. It may not be the worst possible thing, but the natural way to fill in the blank might be there's a reason that I don't know about it, and it's because of a shortcoming that I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it comes down to trust, and trust has a half-life. It degrades. So when you're looking at groups, you have to have these like renewals, these belonging cues that make you remember that you're all on the same team and that you're not going to attack each other and steal each other's food. And it goes back to very basic instincts from early in our evolutionary history. So this again ties to good work practices, where if you can create these micro moments of vulnerability every day, then you're basically renewing the belonging cues that create trust, and then you're less likely to write those stories.
Yeah, and those stories are so often implicit; they're beliefs that we almost don't even realize that we have. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's survival instincts. Yeah. So I think it comes down to some very base evolutionary needs, and that strangers are risky. And what we're talking about is that in a work environment we sometimes lose the perspective that we're all on the same team and that we're on the same group and we're marching towards the same goal, and it can become combative, and conflict can be not healthy. Like healthy conflict is dialectic of perspectives. Unhealthy conflict can easily slip into the picture.
What I find so fascinating about this discussion that we're having right now, if anybody who's listening to this, myself included, has gone to any kind of therapy, particularly if you've ever gone through anything like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, these are the kinds of things that are discussed. The idea that we catastrophize, for example. But most of the time, the prescription is to think through and try to kind of judge from the outside looking in. Imagine that you're an impartial third party looking at your own scenario. But I think the issue that we face is we can't ask people to approach their work with that level of intentional self-awareness without also meeting them where they are, right? In other words, creating the environment, like you're saying, building our tooling in a way that respects that underlying survival instinct and tries to design an environment that doesn't fall, you know, prey to these baser, unproductive instincts.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's not an individual problem; it's a systems problem, and it's yeah, it's absolutely about the environment and making it so people can show up. And I mean, slightly related, but one of the things that's been very influential for me is the work of Robert Keegan out of Harvard Business School and cognitive development levels. And him and Lisa Leahy did a bunch of research into adult cognitive development and identified these milestones, which how people make meaning. And over the course of a day, you are fluctuating between these different levels. So it's not like a purely linear progression. But the base level is just instinctual behavior. So if you're out on the street and you get attacked by a robber, you're going to have an instinctual response. And that is, you know, contextually appropriate and healthy. But you don't want that instinctual response in the workplace, because then that leads to behavior that is just not appropriate. The next level up is a very egocentric view of the world, where it's, you know, very right and wrong and black and white. And that's where you start to think that these people might be out to get you, or they're hiding information. And it's a me-centric view of the world. And then the level above that is your mind literally makes meaning through the group dynamic. So it's like a socialized self, and you think about yourself in the context of the group. And that's where you have these sort of more egalitarian like feelings and altruism and that's you know, if you're at the pub with a group of friends, that's you're going to be in that level, the socialized level. So if you can create that environment at work, that's just a much stronger foundation to have creative discourse. Whereas if everyone's in these lower levels of either the egocentric self or the instinctive self, they're going to be very reactive and not thinking through things from a kind of like a group, what's best for the group.
Yeah, that is, so I wonder when you're saying that this kind of the highest functioning self is one that's in a social atmosphere or a social, kind of the social identity or group identity.
There's actually above that, which
Go ahead.
So the levels above are actually when you then detach, your ego then detaches from the group and you think more institutionally. So the group, the socialized mind has a bunch of strengths, but it can also, that it has some downfalls, like groupthink or being in group out group. But the next level is where you think much more institutionally, and it's a very interesting progression, and it's been very useful for me in sort of analyzing and diagnosing organizational behaviors.
Mm. Can you give an example of the institutional thinking? How might that play out in a workplace?
Honestly, that's where the most creativity happens, and that's where you can avoid some of the downfalls of the in-group, out-group. And when you think it's sort of from a perspective that's slightly decoupled and depersonalized, so you don't think of the marketing team are idiots because, you know, they're not doing XYZ, or the infrastructure team are letting us down. You think more of the system and the perspectives, and that's where empathy occurs and understanding these needs of different groups. So Robert Keegan talks about that as the institutional self versus the socialized self.
Very interesting. I wonder if there's two questions that come to mind when you describe these two these different selves or kind of layers of identity. The first question that comes to mind is: do you think there's a time, or do you think it's possible for that institutional kind of detached self to get confused with the egocentric self? Especially if you're aware of this framework, I can imagine that happening. And the second question that comes to mind is, you know, is there's, it seems that there might be a suppression of individualism or, because you're kind of graduating beyond that egocentrism, how does that, kind of combine with respect for our individual differences and that kind of mindset?
Yeah, I mean that kind of what you're talking about there at the end, that's the kind of the definition of the moving into the institutional space, where it's where you have a very clear sense of identity, but in relation to others.
I see.
So if you think about,
so you begin
kind
to
of like
develop
a sports
respect
team,
for them rather than antagonism.
Yeah. Whereas, like, think of like football supporters. Their identity is so tightly linked to the group, and like a lot of bad things can happen without, you know, that's where the football violence occurred back in the UK, and people get, you know, I remember being in Manchester and there was like red shirts, blue shirts, and you know, you'd hate the people on the other side because it's like so closely linked to the group. So yeah, so moving into these higher levels is that you have this sort of sense of self authorship and self identity, but in relation to groups and the sort of like the broader system.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, when we talk about, you know, going back to the environment, we want to create an environment which is defaults to this sort of socialized mindset where people feel like they're all in the same group and on the same team, that they don't have to worry about threats and like othering. But then that creates the foundation for jumping into these higher cognitive states where you can have healthy conflict, and you can integrate people's perspectives and be more creative.
Yeah. This makes me kind of go back to Range and wonder, you know, what are some practical things that you've done in designing, building this software that integrates some of these philosophies that we've been talking about? I mean, a lot of this stuff is very much, I imagine, nuanced, and small decisions can have cascading effects. So I'm curious, are there any practical ones that you know, are particularly proud of, or were really intentional decisions on your part?
Yeah, at this stage, it seems simple, and there's a few other products that are now doing similar things. But we, every day with your check-in, which is again like a bit like a stand-up, we ask a team building question, and then when you share your mood. And a few years ago, people would be, I don't understand why you would do that. Like, let's just focus on the work. But it actually ends up being really, really impactful. So showing your mood as an emoji, and then red, yellow, green traffic light, is this moment of personal introspection where you're actually trying to, like, how am I actually feeling? And too often people don't have that moment. So choosing it is interesting. And then when you share it, there's actually some like depersonalization in the sharing, where you can share this emoji, which actually might seem silly, but it's less risky than at the start of a meeting saying, I'm really tired because my daughter wasn't sleeping, or I'm feeling like really anxious today because I've got so many things on my plate. So you can just use a grimace emoji or like a sleepy emoji, and it actually makes it much easier to share how you're doing. And then the rest of your team have that perspective. And we often hear from customers where they, you know, you have a manager or a teammate who didn't know that someone on their team was struggling. But this emoji then allows you to have a conversation. So instead of saying like, why are you tired, or like, why you seem stressed, what's going on, you can say like, hey, what's the story behind the grimacing emoji? Or like, is there anything, like, I noticed you're yellow today, is there anything I can do to help? And actually, it makes it feel less judgmental and more safe. So that's like one of the things that we did early on, which many people thought was silly, but has been like surprisingly impactful for both our own team and our customers.
Yeah, this is a practice that I, in a totally different way, have implemented on in my one-on-ones as well as in our stand-ups as much as I can. And the way that we practice it is similarly very definitive and normalizing. I ask for a kind of a 1 to 7. You know, how are you doing? Where 7 is the best possible, and then 1 is you're doing quite awful. And what I've found is the number becomes important for a couple of reasons. One, it forces people to take what is otherwise a non-quantitative internal feeling and try to balance it and figure out all things considered. And so this can actually, I've seen it actually help improve people's moods just on its own, because they say internally, I can kind of see the wheels turning, and I've done it for myself as well, where I had, you know, somebody cut me off in traffic. And we know this from research that small bad things can have a disproportionately negative effect on your day, on your mood. But then I'd start to take into account how I'm doing in other areas. And once I assign something to it, when I say, okay, you know, I really have to try to assign a real number to this, I realize that I'm actually doing better than I thought I was. And it's kind of this weird observational sense that I get that I otherwise wouldn't have had, that I would just kind of, I'm feeling my feelings otherwise, but now I'm kind of observing my feelings. Yeah. And it's all happening because somebody's saying, what number are you?
Yeah. It's essentially a mindfulness exercise where you check in with yourself and you get out of autopilot. And we're so often not conscious of like how we're feeling or how our body is or the tension, and all that then affects how we communicate with each other and how we collaborate. So if you can bring some self-awareness to how you're actually feeling and like what tension you're carrying, and then that can like actually calm some of the transferences, is the psychological term, the transferences that are coming from those like feelings. So yeah, it's very, very, very important.
I'm curious, what got you interested in this deeply psychology-based understanding of product? And was there a moment in time, or was there an experience that you had, or a book that you read or something, where you said, wow, this is really the core of what I care about?
Yeah, it was... So I did this. So I got really interested in how teams work as the starting point, and rethinking management structures to really help people feel empowered and be more like these like sports teams where everyone is playing and everything's dynamic and in the moment you're not being directed by someone, so everyone feels like part of the game. And that got me into thinking about the conditions and like group dynamics, and that led to the psychology. And then it was a leadership training program that I was a part of that really opened my eyes, and it kind of just answered a bunch of questions and around like how people behave and why things unfold in really just like eye-opening way. So that was like and I got really interested in that. And that leadership training program introduced me to the concept of psychological transference. And then I read a bunch about that and how therapists use it in the therapeutic process. And it's just like a really interesting empathy exercise. And trying to like the meaning of our communication is so much of it is subverbal, and so much of it is actually is interpreted by the recipient, and that dynamic is just like super fascinating. And then you can see when it goes wrong, it kind of just like snowballs, and all these seemingly reasonable people are making rash decisions and behaving really inappropriately. So just like understanding the dynamics became just very interesting to me.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode, my interview with Dan Pupias. Thank you again to today's sponsor, Square. Head over to developertea.com/square to get started with the Terminal API. If you don't want to miss out on the second part of my interview with Dan, head over to whatever podcasting app you're currently using. Just open your phone or your computer or whatever and subscribe in that app. That way you don't miss out on future episodes. And if you want to join the Developer Tea Discord, which is a group of developers like you and myself, all chatting in Discord, which is a fantastic platform, by the way. Head over to developertea.com/discord. You can join there. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, enjoy your tea.